Good evening to everybody, and it is good to see a packed church. So as Lisa told us, we will begin in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament. We'll have our talk, and then we'll have a little time for personal prayer, and then some time together for discussion. And I am going to make some confessions to you. When you are a celibate priest, and you get asked to give a talk on rediscovering the fun and beauty in your spouse, what do? Well, you do what any good priest would do. You go to the Catechism of the Catholic Church and start looking up numbers, and you look for fun and beauty in marriage, and it ain't there. So then you do the thing that any woman among you would automatically do, and you do it regularly, it just comes naturally to you, is you pick up the phone and you start talking to other women about their spouses and about their marriage, and that is something that all of the women that I spoke to are professionals at, because they're always talking to everybody about their marriages and about their spouses and about their families. And that is where I gained for you kernels of wisdom gleaned from some of the more exemplary marriages that I know out there. All parties will remain anonymous because, frankly, a lot of you know a lot of them. So Lisa knows everybody. So tonight's talk, that's a long-winded way of saying tonight's talk is not going to be systematic. It's just going to be kind of a scattering of ideas, good ideas, I think, that many of which we probably know, but it's a matter of just remembering and trying to find ways to put this stuff into practice. So the first thought is this. If we want to rediscover the fun and beauty in your spouse, this is kind of the sine qua non. The without this, nothing else is going to happen. It's actually a decision. And I didn't cut, this is not priest talk, okay? Even though I would say it, this actually came from a young mother in her 30s. And one of her first thoughts, things that she said to me, and she's got, I don't know how many kids now, 5 or 6 kids already. But she says, look, it's a decision. You have to make the choice that you're going to recognize what is good in your spouse, recognize what is beautiful, and decide in a certain sense to have fun. Because we get caught up in our own worlds so easily that if we are not conscious and decided and intentional about it, yeah, it sounds almost counterintuitive, right? We have to be intentional about having fun. That's kind of like when my mom used to tell me, she would try to explain to me why her cooking was good. And I'm like, Mom, you know, because my mom grew up in the Great Depression, so she liked some of these Great Depression foods she grew up with because that's all they could afford. And she's telling me why chicken gizzards and all these things are good. And I'm like, you're not convincing me with your argument, right? It's like, it's either good or it isn't. So what am I talking about? This does not mean that we need to white knuckle it, right? You cannot white knuckle marriage, and you cannot white knuckle seeing beauty in your spouse or fun. But I think it is a mentality that has to be there. Abraham Lincoln, who I don't know if you are aware, both he and his wife battled with depression. Seemingly all great geniuses who are world leaders, like Winston Churchill, also battled with depression. His wife battled with it, especially after the untimely death of their child, so that was something that struck her. But I remember Abraham Lincoln, he said, after reflecting on things, he says, most folks are as happy as they make up their minds to be. And there's a lot of wisdom in that. Does that, it's not to denigrate and say psychological illnesses and things don't exist. Yes, they do. But if there's anybody who had lots of things that were going wrong around him and lots of reasons to be stressed and depressed and upset, et cetera, including losing your own child, it's Abraham Lincoln. And he was able to, after observation and prayer and thought, recognize most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. I remember, you cannot change your spouse. This is something you will hear regularly, right? You cannot fix them. Women, are you listening? You cannot fix your husbands, okay? You can love them, You can even try to motivate them. You can try to give them good example, all kinds of other things we can do that might inspire them to act in a good way, but we cannot fix our spouses. I remember I stumbled upon some deep theology when I was a kid. I was probably in about the fifth grade. My parents were going through a tough period, so tough that they ended up actually breaking up their marriage, so there it goes. At the time, I didn't know what was going on. I just knew that Mom would come home from work tired and in a bad mood. And this was a completely selfish thing, so this was not a great virtue on my part. It was just selfishness. But I figured out, if Mom comes home in a bad mood and is grumpy and starts slamming things and you know, being surly, if I'm nice to her for about 30 minutes straight, regardless, her mood will change and she'll be nice again, and the rest of the evening will be fine. That was deep theology. It worked. That was, without my realizing it, a demonstration in the practical world of what Bishop Barron calls the loop of grace. The loop of grace being the idea that God gives grace, we respond to grace. The more we respond to it, the more he gives it. And it's just this ongoing cycle or loop, okay? Well, that was me discovering in my own primitive fifth grade way the loop of grace. Be nice to Mom. She'll eventually start feeling good about life. She'll be nice back. The consequence is it'll be nicer for me. I win. All right? Okay, number two. This is something that many of us have heard a lot about. Many of us have probably tried to put it into practice. Some with great success, others perhaps not. I don't know the answer. But it is, drum roll, date night. How many of you have heard that you can still go on dates when you're married? Okay, it's a thing. Perhaps you have tried and gotten frustrated. There is one of the couples that I know down in somewhere, not too far from here, but down somewhere, but I really respect and admire their marriage. And we periodically we will have these marriage evenings. We refer to them as wine and wisdom. It's this big get together and we have marriage discussions. But they were talking about their date nights. Apparently from, like, the moment they got married, they had already decided, we are going to carve out time that's simply for us. And what happened is, you know, the kids grew up just simply understanding what, I don't know what day of the week it was, and perhaps it changed, maybe it ebbed and flowed, depending on the work schedule and school schedule, but kids grew up understanding whatever that particular evening was, Mom and Dad are untouchable. Okay, unless there is a medical emergency, you know, it's like, kids, take care of yourselves. They've got like 4 or 5 kids. And this is their night. Now, I realize you're like, Father, that's so romantic and wonderful. If only you knew. Like, this did not come from me. This came from them. They're the first to admit that there are all kinds of challenges and roadblocks and it doesn't always work and everything. We got it. But again, I think the critical thing here is going to be intentionality, okay? Do we have the intention, the desire to try to make this work? And if life happens, life happens, okay? But it's a guarantee. If there's no intentionality, it ain't gonna happen because life has a tendency of picking us up and carrying us off. Your kids, you have 4 children and they each decide they want to play a different sport and they go to 3 different schools. Good luck. Unless we are intentional and set aside something like a date night that is concrete and untouchable, you will spend your entire life being a soccer mom or a hockey dad or whatever the particular case may be. A date night could be a family night, but it shouldn't always be a family night. I think there's a lot of value to having, you know, what's the difference between date night and family night? Well, the simple answer is your kids are there, right? Date night doesn't have to be complicated. It could be, it could occasionally take the form of family night and just, you know, watch movies together, play a board game. Remember, okay, most of you are old people like me. You remember board games? Okay, Brenner, I'm sorry, you too. When I grew up and you were watching TV in the evening, every other TV commercial was about some board game. The game of life or shoots of life. I don't even know because we never played them, frankly, but maybe my family would have been better if we did. But board games are actually not a bad thing, okay? Anything that kind of brings the family together in innocent fun. So your date night doesn't necessarily mean going out. Rewind. You can do your date night as a family night sometimes, and I do think it's important to have family time, but there should be some times that are just mom and dad, and it's understood this is us, this is our time, okay? And when the kids see that, you know, of course at the beginning there can be whatever, but kids that grow up with that just being part of their life, they get it. This is just the way it is. Mom and dad need this. The same way that we need, you know, as kids to do whatever our things are. Date night does not always mean going out, and it doesn't necessarily mean doing anything fancy. One of the illustrious moms that I spoke to was saying, she said, look, recently my husband just determined we're going to start bowling, okay? And the wife is horrible at bowling and admits that she's horrible at bowling and it just wasn't a thing, but she started going along just, okay, well, we're going to do this together, we're going to go bowling. And she says it's actually, the word she used was hilarious, okay? She said it's hilarious to go bowling because she's so bad. But as long as nobody cares, you know, and they go out and they meet other couples and, you know, they're creating new circles of friends, it is time that they do something together. Sometimes date night might just be being in a separate part of the house. It depends on the size of your house, frankly. Some of you, if you happen to live in a matchbox and you are exactly on the other side of your children's bedroom, that might not work so well. But sometimes we have the potential or the possibility of, like, you know, kids are over here in their room or doing their thing, and date night is we're just together in the living room and just talking or doing whatever we like to do together. It can be as simple as that. It's just simply a matter of taking time together to bond. And one of the things, this corresponds both to all of my theological studies, but again, it came from the wise lips of a young lady in her 30s. Married with children, she said, whatever you do for each other is done for your children. Actually, this didn't come from that lady, it came from a different one, but whatever you do for each other, whatever you do for your marriage and for your spouse is done for your children. What's that mean? It means the greatest gift we can give our children is a strong, unified marriage. If the couple is at each other's throats, it doesn't matter how many trips to Disneyland or what schools your kids go to or what sports or any of those things, none of that matters. The greatest gift we can give our kids is the loving example of the marriage, of the love between husband and wife, father and mother. When there is that stability, things work out. Yeah, you can have all kinds of headaches and life happens again, but the family will remain, your children will grow up with moral stability. Frankly, if we look at so many of the problems in society, what percentage of the confusion and the children who have gender dysphoria or attempted suicide or all of these things, what percentage of those things can be boiled down to just simply kind of a fragmented family life? I don't have the numbers on me, but the research is pretty stark. Number three, I don't know if you've been taking numbers, but number three. You guys are supposed to be taking notes, by the way. Come on. We're going to quiz you on this stuff later. Number three came from another wise, one of my wise Regnum Christi ladies. Different one this time. She's actually kind of my main point of reference. Do random things together. Okay, this is kind of a corollary of date night. Okay. Now, what does it mean to do random things together? It means that you don't even, in a certain sense, always have to plan a date, but just the fact that you do hobbies or things, participate in each other's interests for the sake of the fact that it's the other's interest. Now, this particular couple, I guess They're pretty much empty nesters now, so they've got a little bit more time on their hands. But you're going to laugh when you tell me some of the things that they do that are random that they do together. So the husband, who grew up in the Bronx, by the way, so I don't know where he got this farmer streak in him, but he loves like tractors and stuff. So they go to this like tractor store and are looking at stuff. And she's going with them, and she actually has a good time because for the simple fact that she's there together participating in something that he likes to do. The same person said, "You're going to laugh at me, Father, but sometimes we just go to Costco together and hang out." Something, again, you know, I don't even know if they have any particular shopping needs. They probably figured they'll notice it when they see it. But just going and spending time, just hanging out, doing random things together. The same person referred to, there's a famous book of philosophy by a philosopher by the name of Joseph Pieper. Not spelled like P-E-E-P-E-R. It's not like a, you know, whatever. but he was a German philosopher, and he wrote this book called Leisure as the Basis of Culture. Has anybody ever heard of that expression? The fact that leisure is the basis of pretty much all of our culture. And the basic idea was this. He kind of did this historical study. He looks through, especially being European, there's a lot of history there. He says, what are the periods that produced all the great music and all the great art and all the great food and dance and clothing and style and all the beautiful things that are out there? Says it does not come from periods of war. And it also does not come from, like, you know, the Industrial Revolution, where it's the rat race, or where the pharaoh with the king of Egypt, you know, with a bunch of slaves. It comes when people have enough time to sit back and to think, to reflect, to enjoy, and to create spaces of silence. I actually looked up, even though we all know what the word leisure means, I went to the effort of going to the Oxford Dictionary to find the official definition of leisure. And it is this: the use of free time for enjoyment. Okay, so it doesn't mean being a bum. It doesn't mean couch potato. It means the use of free time for enjoyment. Can that lead to excesses? Sure. There's a healthy, actually we're going to get to another fancy word later on. There's a healthy version of leisure, and then there is an excessive, you know, my brain is shut off tonight, so all my fancy words are disappearing, but you get the point. There is a hedonistic version of leisure as well. So leisure enables silence, and silence is what gives us space to hear, which is why we will also have silence. We will have some moments of leisure in the Lord in just a few moments. So this person told me a story, and this is an interesting one. She said there was, I don't know how many years ago, but they had received all the storm notifications that a big blizzard or something was supposed to come blowing through. And they spent the entire day ahead of time, you know, preparing, brought firewood inside, and she cooked meals ahead of time unless they lost their electricity and gas and everything. They were ready to go. And spent an entire day just setting up, getting ready for this storm. It never showed up. So then what do? Well, they realize we've got an entire day, essentially with no work to do because we've already done it. They killed themselves the day before, and they just hung out. And again, just she said, this was actually one of my favorite days of being married. The day that the storm didn't show up, and we just were kind of looking at each other and just like, well, let's just hang out. Let's just be together and do nothing. There is a Greek virtue. This came from Aristotle, but it's starting to become in mode in theological circles again. Who here has ever heard of eutropalia? Not even Brenner. Or if you want to be one of these Latin speakers, even though it's a Greek word, but eutropalia. Eutropalia. Neutropenia is, it's actually a virtue that Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas talk about, okay? So it's serious. And it is the virtue of pleasantness, ease, and good humor. How can that be a virtue, right? Okay, what it essentially means is this. It is that happy middle ground in between being, on the one hand, a clown, and on the other hand, just being a bore, somebody who's humorless and cold. In between, there's that happy middle ground. And you see it, actually kids frequently are a good example of that. When kids are in a stable, happy setting with friends and family and whatnot, they just kind of naturally play because they are spiritually and psychologically at peace. And, you know, happiness and laughter and those things just kind of come naturally, right? And the same thing happens when old friends are reunited or when people who love each other spend a lot of time together or old war buddies or whatever. Whenever we spend time in a setting of authentic love, in a setting of authentic where you feel comfortable in your skin, comfortable around these people, it's a good setting for eutropelia. Okay? Here's the thing. The devil hates a good sense of humor. This is a serious point. The devil hates a good sense of humor. The devil is deathly serious. He takes himself way too seriously. One thing if you notice about saints, rule of thumb, saints have a good sense of humor. They don't take themselves generally seriously at all. They take God seriously. They take salvation seriously, they take a lot of other things seriously, but they realize, I'm really not that big a deal. How many of our problems, and especially in our marriages, come down to the fact that if we want to be honest with ourselves, it's because we make a big deal out of ourselves. He's not respecting me the way he... It's like, get over it, sister. Okay? That is the root of so many of our issues. We take ourselves way too seriously, and then it starts becoming about us, and we start judging the other person because he didn't take me into consideration and all these other things. And realistically, if we can get out of ourselves a little bit and lift up our eyes and start seeking, how can I, instead of thinking so much about how I feel about things, how can I make the other person the focal point? How can I make my spouse happy? How can I serve my children and the family? How can I set aside little petty things that may or may not get under my skin? There may be times that you want to communicate about it and at least let them know, hey, you know, this kind of gets under my skin. But nonetheless, not to make life so much about ourselves. The more that's ultimately what the Christian virtue of charity comes down to. Seeking the good of the other for their own sake. There was a saint, he is one of the saints of, amongst other things, of comedians, St. Thomas More, the saint of the conscience. And he got famous because he was the Chancellor of England, which means essentially that the king was the figurehead, but the guy who actually did all the dirty work of running the country was the Chancellor. The king he had the good pleasure of serving was a fellow by the name of Henry VIII. Okay, can you see where this is going? Henry VIII was an extremely proud person who one day up and decides, I'm not having any success having children with this wife. I would like a divorce and get another wife. And the Pope said no. So Henry VIII broke off, strong arms all the English bishops into agreeing with him, except for one or two notable exceptions. And starts his own church and says, we are now the Catholic Church of England, which eventually just became the Church of England, and made himself the head of the Church of England. Complete usurpation of power. Okay, so Thomas More is his chancellor. Actually never spoke out against it. He just simply wouldn't say anything, but that wasn't good enough. So gets thrown in prison, eventually falsely accused, condemned to death. At his execution, Henry VIII forbade anybody to speak because he knew Thomas More was capable of cracking some joke and ruining the entire thing. So he didn't take himself or any of these things too seriously. He forbade people to speak so that it would be a grim and solemn moment. That's the devil's logic. Hilaire Belloc, who some of you may have heard of, he's a famous English writer a little bit before J.R.R. Tolkien, more or less contemporary of G.K. Chesterton, good friend of Chesterton, C.S. Lewis, all those brilliant English writers in the first half of the 20th century. Actually, Belloc was French, but he hung out in the Oxford circles. Had a famous expression. He said, "Wherever the Catholic Church doth shine, there's always laughter and good red wine. At least I've always found it so, Benedicamus Domino." Benedicamus Domino just means, let us praise the Lord. So, what does all this have to say? One healthy pointer is, let's learn to laugh at things and not take things so seriously. Okay, last point, and then we'll give you a few moments of adoration. Arguably the most important. Presume good intent in your spouse. You did not marry your spouse because you did not trust them. You did not think, there is an untrustworthy person who thinks badly of me and is only going to be mean and treat me badly and ignore me and all those things. I want to marry that one. Okay? You clearly saw something beautiful and noble that is clearly there in your spouse. Some of you are nudging each other. Okay. You wouldn't have married this person if they were the devil. Okay? So, presume good intent. And one little trick that can help us to do that, this will be our final point, is this. We should have a ticker tape of gratitude. Everyone here know what ticker tape is? In the old days, like the stock market, it would constantly spit out. Or same thing with horse races and stuff. A ticker tape, which is a running account of gratitude. So constantly taking stock of all the things that I should be grateful to my spouse for. When we have this ticker tape of gratitude, it's a very strong counterbalance to all the annoying things that your spouse inevitably does, or the things that they don't do that are also annoying. So, we are here in the presence of our Lord, and I would encourage us, let's just take a few moments. I've been talking too long, as is my wont, so maybe we can take about 5 minutes of silent prayer and another 5 minutes or so of personal conversation. Does that work with the boss? Okay, and then we'll have benediction. I did not mention it, and I apologize. If anybody would care to go to confession either now or perhaps afterward, Father Jorge is patiently waiting in the back. I would hear your confession, but I will just get you sick.